But first to the war in Ukraine and the negotiations to bring it to an end, what the Economist called a baffling week of Trumpian diplomacy.
The United States and Russia are believed to have drafted a new framework to end the Russia-Ukraine war. Under this plan, which covers 28 points,
now the president is making it sound like the 28 points were much more of a starting point than a done deal.
It's this sort of 19-point plan that's sort of the living document that the United States is working from and now is going to have to obviously take that back to the Russian side.
A leaked transcript of a call between Trump envoy Steve Witkoff and one of Putin's top aides.
Yeah, it's all been a bit confusing. A 28-point peace plan, which was very Kremlin-friendly, became a 19-point peace plan following pushback from Ukraine and its European allies. And we also had that extraordinary leak of a phone call between Donald Trump's personal envoy, Steve Witkoff, and a senior Kremlin official, where he seemed almost to be coaching the Russians on how to negotiate with Donald Trump. Just before coming on air, I spoke to Samantha Debenden from the Russian and Eurasia program at Chatham House. I asked what had changed over the course of the past week.
What has changed in the latest peace plan as of yesterday is that the Ukrainian army was going to be capped at 800,000, not 600,000. The idea of a blank amnesty for Russia's war crimes was dropped. But and it was generally seemed to be more favourable to Ukraine, but the two main questions were not addressed in this peace plan. And one is territorial concessions or not by Ukraine, and whether or not Ukraine will be getting security guarantees and what these security guarantees will be. This does not exist in any plan that is being publicly discussed right now. Marco Rubio told his European counterparts yesterday that the United States will not discuss security guarantees with Ukraine until a peace plan is signed. So it's all incredibly confusing at the moment. Vladimir Putin says he doesn't even think a peace plan exists. They're just propositions. The Europeans have been coming up with their own peace plan. It is a mess. Unfortunately,
I think it's true to say there was panic this time last week in Kyiv, wasn't it? It looked like the Trump administration was siding again with Vladimir Putin. This was such a Kremlin-friendly 28-point plan. There was panic in most European capitals as well. You are there in Paris. You would have sensed that. There were these negotiations in Geneva. I mean, tell us how the Europeans and the Ukrainian negotiators managed to exert some pushback on that original plan.
Well, first of all, the original plan was Kremlin-friendly because it looks as though it was actually drafted mainly by the Kremlin. What we have seen is the Europeans and the Ukrainians have been speaking to a different branch of the American administration. They've been speaking mainly with Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. And he has a much more, first of all, he has a much deeper understanding of Russia. He has a much deeper understanding of international affairs, full stop. So he was able to agree to the idea of a peace plan that did not only reflect Russian concerns, but that was more friendly to Ukraine. What shocked a lot of Ukrainians in the European version of the peace plan was that Russia would be readmitted to the G8. But what I really have to emphasize at this point is that nothing is being negotiated between the Ukrainians and the Russians. The only negotiation that will have any value, the only peace plan that can actually be called a peace plan and not a wish list, is whatever will come out from whatever negotiations, if they ever actually happen, between the Ukrainians and the Russians. Because what we have now is we've got the Americans negotiating with the Russians. We've then got the Americans and the Ukrainians and the Europeans negotiating together. Then you've got the Ukrainians and the Europeans talking to each other. Then you've got the Europeans negotiating amongst themselves. But this is not a negotiation. These are discussions. These are things being put on the table. Putin is saying he's not aware of anything. He's playing dumb. He says, I haven't seen any real peace plan.
There just seems to be so much confusion. And as you say, adding to that confusion is a lack of coherence within the Trump administration itself, and you talk about that divide, the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who's more of a Republican foreign policy traditionalist, sort of tougher on Russia. And then you've got this guy, Steve Witkoff, who's Trump's personal envoy, who remarkably has never been to Ukraine. He seems much more amenable to Vladimir Putin. Adding to the confusion of all of this, Samantha, presumably these internal discussions within the Trump administration.
Yes, well, what seems to be happening, there seems to be a bit of rivalry happening within the Trump administration, because you've got, on the one hand, as you said, Marco Rubio, traditional Republican foreign policy expert. On the other hand, you've got the Witkoff-Trump team. And then you've got a third team, which is closer to the Witkoff-Trump team, which is Dan Driscoll, who's the United States Secretary of the Army, who has been going to Kiev, who is in Abu Dhabi, who is very close to J.D. Vance. I mean, they were at Yale together. You know, if you listen to the Washington rumor mill, that J.D. Vance and Driscoll are positioning themselves to be the Republican nominee in the next presidential elections. Marco Rubio also wants to be a nominee. Mm. So we're even dealing with internal Republican politics here as to who will potentially be the nominee if Trump doesn't decide he's going to have a third term, which is, of course, something that's not to be ruled out. What none of them seem to understand is that bringing peace to Ukraine also has to be agreed by the Ukrainians, that Ukraine is actually a democracy, and that if there's a plan that's rammed down their throat, there could be an internal rebellion within the country. And that's something that nobody seems to take into consideration.
Samantha, tell me about something that was quite remarkable this week, that the leak of this telephone conversation between Steve Witkoff and a senior figure, a senior Kremlin foreign policy advisor, Yuri Ushakov. He seemed almost to be coaching the Russians about how to negotiate and how to deal with Donald Trump. What did you make of that?
Well, I think that it could be high treason. That is what it is. There's been a lot of arguments saying Witkoff is trying to get across the American point of view. He's a sort of wily negotiator. I don't actually get that, because what Witkoff is doing, he's not trying to push the American agenda. He's trying to actually understand what the Russians want and tell the Russians, well, this is what you have to do to get what you want. He's not saying, we want this. He's saying, okay, you want that. This is how I will help you get it. That is a fundamental problem. He's not behaving like a negotiator. He's behaving like someone who is an intelligence asset, giving information to the opposing side and saying, if you want to get what you want, this is what you have to do. Now, there are people who have argued, well, everybody knows you have to cajole Trump. He hasn't actually given them any sensitive information. That's true, but it's the whole attitude. He's positioning himself to the Russians as somebody who is on their side. And that is very, very dangerous.
Let's talk about the politics in Ukraine. It's been beset by scandal, allegations involving close aides of Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president. Here in Australia, we've woken up to the news that Zelensky's chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, has resigned following an anti-corruption raid on his home, although he hasn't been accused of any wrongdoing at the moment. Throughout the war, he's been the president's closest and most trusted advisor. He's been a key figure in these negotiations. I wonder how the internal politics of Ukraine are going to make this even more confusing and even more difficult.
Well, it is going to make it more confusing and more difficult. It's also very, very murky and opaque. So Andriy Yermak is hated by a lot of people in Ukraine. He's not very liked in European diplomatic circles. He's widely viewed as being corrupt, although there is nothing, there's no proof against him. He's viewed as the person who guards, you know, access to Zelensky like a sort of vicious guard dog. Rumors upon rumors that, you know, if you want to see Zelensky, you have to pay Yermak, and that's how you get to him. But the fact that he's had to resign at this point is actually very serious. Now, a lot of people in Ukraine who don't like Yermak and who don't like Zelensky are very concerned that this corruption scandal has erupted right now when Ukraine is facing maximum pressure from the United States. And some of my very highly placed Ukrainian contacts have reminded me that NABU, the anti-corruption agency in Ukraine, was actually set up by the Americans It was at one point considered to be very favorable to the Democrats, but there is an FBI representative permanently inside NABU. Now, how convenient is it for the United States, who want to put maximum pressure on Zelensky, that all this happens right now? Right now, the country is suffering from missiles raining on it every single day, killing civilians, women, children, every single day. That is a lot worse than dealing with corruption. And so they need to get this war over with people who are in charge and who have legitimacy. Now the people in charge are sadly losing legitimacy, and that is a problem.
It's crucial that you brought up the ongoing war. I mean, amidst all these negotiations, it's important to remember that blood is still being shed. People are dying. There's also this perception that Ukraine is losing the military battle. Russia isn't making major gains and major breakthroughs, but it does seem to have the upper hand in this war of attrition. Again, how is that going to impact the dynamics of this process?
Russia's economy is suffering. There are serious economists who are looking at how long Russia's economy can last without having serious problems. And the end of the winter is a date that's often cited. And that is also why the Ukrainians are so desperate to cling on and to not give in now, because they feel that six more months of Russian winter, yes, Ukrainian winter is going to be hard, but a Russian winter in which the sanctions are really going to bite, and the continual harassment that the Ukrainians are subjecting the Russians to might get to a point where things will begin to crack inside Russia.
Samantha, it's hard to make sense of what's happened in the past week. It's very difficult to project ahead to see what will happen. But what is your best guess, looking into a very kind of murky crystal ball?
Well, my crystal ball is murky, and it's really murky because right now we don't know if the Europeans are going to stand up and actually decide they want to defend Ukraine, because they're defending their continent. The Europeans could do things like protect Ukraine with a sky shield, parts of Western Ukraine. They could give more weapons to Ukraine today. If they don't do that, what we risk is we risk a capitulation by Zelensky because of all the pressure he's under. That could potentially lead to civil war or serious unrest in Ukraine, or Russia somehow takes over Ukraine, and all these highly trained men and women in Ukraine's army and all these weapons on Ukrainian territory could be directed against Europe, because that's what Russia does. Whenever it invades anywhere, it absorbs the armed forces into its own armed forces and directs them against its enemy.
Samantha Dibenden, thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day.
That was Samantha Dibenden of Chatham House in London speaking to us from Paris.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.